Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the just-concluded state visit by Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani and the country's Chief Executive Officer Abdullah Abdullah, and look into the hidden history of U.S.-Afghan relations prior to America's longest war that may or may not be concluding soon. Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon and is the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, joins us to discuss how the real victims in the country called the Graveyard of Empires are not so much the foreign invaders, but the Afghan people. Then we will speak with Ambassador John Campbell, the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies and a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, about recent military reversals that have driven Boko Haram out of much of the territory in the north that they had occupied, which is suddenly happening a week ahead of an election after 4 years of paralysis by the government of Goodluck Jonathan. We'll look into the fate of hundreds who have been kidnapped and the role of South African mercenaries in routing Boko Haram. Then finally, we will speak with James Stock, a professor of political economy at Harvard and a member of the faculty at Harvard's Kennedy School. He previously served as a member of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisers and has an op-ed at the New York Times, The Real Cost of Coal, that reveals how 40% of coal is mined from public lands, but the taxpayer gets little back in terms of royalties and nothing in terms of compensation for the effects of climate change caused by CO2 from burning coal. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And yesterday there was the state visit at the White House and the state dinner with Obama, of course, and President Ashraf Ghani and the chief executive officer, as he's called, of Afghanistan, Abdullah Abdullah. They've been asking for more troops, etc. But, you know, all of this is happening at the time when this outrageous murder of this woman who was literally ripped to shreds by a mob over a false charge by a local mullah who she'd apparently had a run-in with, and then he screamed fire in a crowded theater, if you will, saying she'd burned the Quran, and that was a death sentence for her. And this happened, you know, in front of a number of police officers who stood by as this mob tore this poor unfortunate woman who apparently had mental problems. They tore her apart. So it makes you wonder what the hell this sacrifice has been for this country.
Well, this is a rather bleak and I'm afraid vivid portrait of the two Afghanistans that we have after almost $1 trillion spent and altogether in Western forces more than 1 million men deployed at 13 years. I mean, this is part of the paradox and the tragedy here. Of all the blundering, all of the wrong assumptions, all of the misconceptions about state building and about the American mission there, what could and should have been accomplished, and of course, all of it based on an abysmal ignorance of Afghanistan as a culture, as a political society, and all the rest. And you've got, meanwhile, this spectacle in Washington of two of the more westernized and presentable Afghan politicians. They've been around for a long time. The president has a long history of international prominence as a writer and as an activist on the whole issue of state building and the rule of law and changing primitive third world societies into modern states. And of course, his number two, and this was an electoral compromise, Abdullah has a long history as a former foreign minister and has been around for a long. These are both These are both veterans of the 1980s and 90s in American-Afghan relations. They survived. They are cut from pretty much the same cloth as former President Karzai in terms of their relationship with the United States, with the CIA and with the Pentagon and all the rest. And they are, for better and for worse, the government that we are left with here after this rather major American investment, which has come to naught. So this is not a pretty picture, Ian, and the two Afghanistans on the ground there in Kabul witnessed the not just the riot that killed the poor young woman, but also the demonstration that followed. I mean, you had women in the streets, which was rather common in the old Afghanistan. There were demonstrations allowed both under the pre-communist regime and in the communist years, and people did go into the streets protesting this kind of atavism. But it's still a very, very strong force in Afghan society, especially in the countryside. Almost nothing that we have been told about the progress of Afghanistan in terms of education and health care and the general advance of the society has been quite true. You know, there are a series of books now by some really first-rate American journalists who have penetrated the veil, as it were, of misconception. And Gopal's book, No Good Man Among the Living, I would recommend very, very highly for dispelling much of the mythology about Afghanistan. But you're quite right. It's a terrible picture, and it's not going to change anytime soon.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. So in terms of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, of course, we blundered into Vietnam without knowing anything about the history and culture of that country. Now, intervention was premised on the idea that it was a domino about to fall as communism spread from communist China south. And, of course, our ignorance was so profound that we didn't even know that the Chinese and the Vietnamese were traditional enemies. And the minute that the Vietnam War ended, China and Vietnam went to war. So that's an example, I think, of which was repeated in Afghanistan. Of course, we went into Afghanistan because of the 9/11 attacks, but at least you would have thought somebody would have heard somewhere in the bureaucracy that Afghanistan has the reputation as the graveyard of empires.
Well, I think that's true to some extent, but my book deals in detail with a much earlier history as well. American intervention really began covertly in the country way back in the 1950s. Our policy, as you may remember, was quite hostage to our alliance with Pakistan. This is all Cold War politics. And we have a very, very sordid and checkered history in Afghanistan covertly, really from the 1940s on. It was the staging ground for a rather famous coup d'etat in the Middle East, the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. It subsequently became a kind of covert as well as overt foreign aid battleground of the United States and the Soviet Union. And the United States played a very, very decisive and major role furtively behind the scenes in provoking, really, in a very direct sense, the Soviet invasion in December 1979. This is a history which is ancient now for current American politics and certainly for policymakers, but it's all too relevant because the Afghanistan we face today is very much the product politically and culturally of that era. We quite literally as a matter of national policy, set about destroying those secular and potentially democratic forces in Afghanistan, both in the center and on the left, who were inimical to our purposes in the Cold War. And that struggle, which took place, of course, as you know, in the 1980s, the covert war against the Soviet occupation and invasion and their puppet regime in Kabul, in which we were allied with the Mujahideen, the original version of the Afghan Islamist radicals that we are now fighting in different incarnations elsewhere in the Middle East. That war had a disastrous effect on the political setting in Afghanistan. So that in after 9/11 and that attack purportedly to rid the country of Al Qaeda and to find Bin Laden and all the rest came with a political culture and a setting in which the United States was quite culpable, and at the same time thoroughly ignorant. So that, and then the following 13 years of the American War, which is longer, of course, than any of the legendary Afghan wars that the British or anybody else fought, longer certainly than the Soviet War, really had the effect of compounding all of this. We created almost out of whole cloth a wholly new enemy in the post-Taliban Taliban. It's a new phenomenon, thoroughly nationalist and to some extent as rabidly Islamist as the old Taliban, but new people and a new passion against the West. This is a microcosm, as you know, Ian, of much of American foreign policy across the region. It isn't just Afghanistan that we have blundered in, spent so much money and so much national treasure and lives. It's of course the same story in Iraq, and we're seeing it in Syria and with Daesh and all of this incredible mess in a Middle East which is really collapsing, and it's mirroring, of course, a collapse of American foreign policy, not just under one administration, not just George W. Bush or Barack Obama, but over the last 50 to 60 years.
So, Roger Morris, just going back to prior to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, how much, and you've uncovered a lot of this information from previously secret documents, how much did the Carter administration, Brzezinski, et cetera, stir the pot there and, in effect, invite the Soviets in? Because I understand there were Afghan Mujahideen raiding the stands, the Soviet-occupied stands, to the point where the Russians got sick of it. And so how much did we provoke that invasion, do you think?
Well, we were working on at several different levels. First of all, we were involved covertly with the resistance to the communist regimes. This is before the Soviet invasion. They came to power in April of 1978, and we began almost immediately that summer and fall in collusion with the Chinese and with the Iranians and the Pakistanis, and then it was Iran, of course, under the Shah at that time, to try to subvert and overthrow that government. It wasn't the first time we had armed rebels. We had adopted the Islamists as early as 1973 against a completely non-communist government. This is the pre-April coup government of a man named Daoud, who was, if anything, quite a right-wing authoritarian, semi-fascist figure. So American involvement there goes back a long way, and that that covert support of the rebels in 1978 and 79 had increasingly disastrous effects on the Soviets. We were key in arming a rebellion in the spring of 1979 in Herat, in this wonderful ancient city, ancient capital in western Afghanistan, which ended up being a slaughter of Soviet, not just Soviet aid and military advisors, but of their accompanying families, one of the worst atrocities in the history of international foreign aid. And all of that, of course, climaxed with the political crisis in Afghanistan in the fall of 1979, when an internal quarrel in the Communist Party there led to the emergence of a man named Hafizullah Amin, who had overthrown his patron and superior, a man named Taraki, came to power and began to fashion a much more independent foreign policy of the Soviet Union, despite billions in Soviet aid and a very large Soviet presence already in the country. And the United States was involved covertly in supporting much of that, and in a kind of flirtation with Amin. This all takes place, Ian, as all these things do, constantly in the context of larger events. The Soviets were very, very nervous about what American reactions would be to the fall of the Shah of Iran, which took place as you remember, in January of 1979. There was concern in Moscow that the United States would try to stage a kind of coup d'etat or a kind of takeover in Afghanistan to compensate for its loss of Iran, its loss of the Shah's regime, and the emergence of the Ayatollah and that theocracy. There was grave concern, which the United States in various ways covertly encouraged, that the Americans would use Afghanistan as a monitoring base and even potentially as a missile base, right there on the soft underbelly of the Soviet Union, with only minutes of warning time between that and Soviet missile sites, strategic sites in Central Asia and Central Russia. So there are lots of dimensions here. One of the unknown factors in all of this, which has never been admitted really by the United States publicly, and this will resonate in terms of our own era here with NSA and its eavesdropping on everybody, is that we had access during a crucial period of time in 1979 to Soviet codes. And we were literally reading for the first time in a very long while, and that soon changed. But we were reading Soviet mail, which gave the Carter administration and Brzezinski, in very specific terms, an enormous advantage in all of this manipulation. But there is no question, I think the documentary record is clear, that the United States was certainly to some extent culpable in provoking that invasion.
And of course, once the invasion happened, it seemed, at least in retrospect, that in many ways what motivated the U.S. to get involved with arming the Mujahideen and all that, which resulted in all the subsequent blowback, etc., was it not to basically pay the Russians back for what happened in Vietnam? They were.
Oh yeah, Brzezinski. We have the memoranda. Much of the record, I have to say, from the late 1970s, and certainly the vast majority of important documents of the 1980s are still secret, still hidden. This is not just open ground in terms of declassification, but we do know a great deal about what was going on in the White House, what Brzezinski was saying to Carter, and there's a famous series of memoranda during 1979, and then particularly just after the Soviet invasion, talking about giving the Russians their Vietnam. Brzezinski later gives a rather famous interview to a French a newspaper saying, well, we didn't deliberately provoke them, but we made it easier for them to come in. And that's the time in which he says, I can't imagine that this was a mistake. What's more important, the fall of the Soviet Union and the liberation of Eastern Europe, which all of which he attributed to the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan, or the upsetting of a few Muslims? This was a different era in American foreign policy and a different set of characters. Jimmy Carter is not in 1978-79 the humanitarian peacemaking mediator that he became so famously and is now, quite laudably, I think, as a post president. He is very much a cold warrior. He's pursuing covert wars against the Soviet Union in various places, as much or more sometimes than his more famous successor in that respect, Ronald Reagan. But it's one of those unappreciated and largely unknown histories that Democrats and liberals and progressives don't tend to look at very much, because of course it's their president who is in this case directly responsible.
And the Afghan people ultimately are the collateral damage in this.
Oh my goodness! The current that runs through this entire story from the very beginning, really, because the U.S. is culpable in various Pakistani plots during the 50s and 60s and 70s, and it's a continuing theme, which is quite sad, is that the Afghans are expendable. They're expendable, and they're cannon fodder for American purposes in terms of domestic politics, in terms of other geopolitical considerations, the Cold War vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, policy in the rest of the Middle East, always American policy in Pakistan. There is no American policy in Afghanistan purely to speak of. It is always an appendage and always hostage to American aims and what we conceive of as our stakes in Pakistan. So this is it's a complex story of the Cold War, obviously in the first instance, but it's also a story of American blundering and ignorance, our inability to understand and to see and to cope with any sensibility, a society which, after all, was not all that complex. The great legend about the Afghans is that they were unconquerable and unknowable, incomprehensible people. And neither of those was true. I think you're right that, yes, there is this cliche of the graveyard of empires, but more often Afghanistan has been the recourse and the battleground, really, of foreign powers working out their own fears and vengeance. And most of the graves, after all, tend to be Afghan, not foreign at all. And as a people, no nation state in the modern world has suffered more from foreign intervention, has seen more of its people proportionately killed and displaced than Afghanistan.
Roger Morris, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is a comparative history of the inner politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria about the routing of Boko Haram. پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی و چند Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador John Campbell, who's the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies and a career Foreign Service officer and former ambassador to Nigeria. He was a political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections, and his book, Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, is in its second edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador John Campbell.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And next week, there are elections in Nigeria, and for some reason, the Nigerian government of Goodluck Jonathan has been incapable of dealing with Boko Haram for what seems like years, and there's been endless stories of massacres and mass kidnapping and abductions of young women and extraordinary atrocities conducted by this very brutal and strange group of rebels, I guess. But now, all of a sudden, they appear to be getting rolled up just ahead of the elections. And people, I guess, in Nigeria must be asking, why is it that in the last few weeks they've been able to take on Boko Haram just before the election when they seem incapable of doing so for the last couple of years?
That indeed is the question. Actually, for the last 4 years. Over the past 4 years, we've had one report after another of Boko Haram out fighting the Nigerian military, of the Nigerian military going into firefights with only 30 bullets, with Nigerian soldiers not being paid, and the Nigerian military having very low morale. And yet, as you just said, in the past 5 weeks, Boko Haram has been dislodged from extensive territories that it had occupied over the past several years. What has happened? The Nigerian government's response to that question is to say that that it has been focusing a great many more resources on the issue, and it acknowledges that it made a mistake by not doing so earlier. For me, that explanation really isn't terribly satisfactory. 5 weeks is too short a time to bring about a transformation of a military, no matter how many resources you throw at it. Instead, I would look to two other factors. The first is the operation of Chadian and Nigerian military forces against Boko Haram, but within Nigerian territory. The Chadians appear to be well-trained by the French. They were successful in Mali, and they appear to have been successful in parts of northern Nigeria. There was a report yesterday morning, of Chadians, however, complaining that when they dislodged Boko Haram from a particular town, they were not relieved by incoming Nigerian soldiers. Where are the Nigerians, was their question. So the operation of Chadians and Nigerians, I think, may be part of the explanation. I'm also interested in the possible role being played by what the Nigerian government calls technical advisors and what I would call mercenaries. They may number in several hundred. There have been reports that they come from South Africa, from the Ukraine, and from Georgia, and that they are well-equipped, that they use night vision to dislodge Boko Haram from places that they occupy, and then, at least in theory, turn those places over to the Nigerian military the following day. We have seen before that a highly trained mercenary force operating against militants in Africa can be quite successful. We saw it, for example, in Sierra Leone, and the operation of South African mercenaries during the apartheid period, both in South Africa and in Angola, was notorious.
So how do you think this is affecting next week's elections? I mean, given that we've both expressed skepticism at this sudden reversal on the part of the government of Goodluck Jonathan, which I imagine is pretty pervasive. That same feeling is pretty pervasive in Nigeria itself.
Good question. the areas that have been retaken from Boko Haram, my impression, and I say impression because we have remarkably few hard facts about northeastern Nigeria, not least because the international media has many, many difficulties in something as simple as getting visas to go there. But nevertheless, my impression is that many of these towns that have been retaken from Boko Haram are little more than smoking ruins, and that there are hardly any people there. So where are the people? Presumably, they're internally displaced. Will they be able to vote? The head of the Independent National Electoral Commission says that they can. The part of the country they're from would normally support Jonathan's opposition, Muhammadu Buhari. But the question will be whether, in fact, they can vote at all. I think we have to anticipate that there will be Boko Haram attacks on people who are trying to vote. Now, as to the impact on the Jonathan campaign in other parts of the country, that remains to be seen. Jonathan can trumpet that, in fact, the Nigerian military has reoccupied much of northeastern Nigeria. The fact of that, it has not defeated Boko Haram, may or may not resonate with people, particularly if they're looking at maps of Nigeria that show chunks of territory once occupied by Boko Haram, but now occupied by the Nigerian army.
Again, let me remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Ambassador John Campbell, who's the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies and a career Foreign Service officer and former ambassador to Nigeria. He was a political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections, and his book, Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, is in its second edition. And given that the all-progressive Congress of Muhammadu Buhari is challenging the incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan and his People's Democratic Party, and the country, I suppose, is largely this is a superficial observation, but it is often said to be that, you know, you've got the Muslim North and the Christian South. Is that the divide that will define this election? I mean, in other words, Goodluck Jonathan's fate will be in how disillusioned his own supporters in the South are, surely.
I think that's broadly correct, based essentially on anecdotal evidence, because polling is not very strong in Nigeria. It looks to me like Buhari's greatest strength is in the north, the traditionally Muslim parts of the country, but also, and this is new, in the western part of the country, the area around Lagos, where Christianity and Islam are roughly equal in their number of adherents, and the relationships between Christians and Muslims is quite different from what it is in the north. They intermarry with each other, they keep each other's holidays, and so forth. Jonathan's support would seem to be heavily in the oil patch in the south, and the area that would seem to be in play between the two is a broad swath of territory across the middle of the country, called, not surprisingly, the Middle Belt, which is an area where there has been considerable ethnic and religious violence over the past couple of years.
Well, when you were saying earlier, Ambassador Campbell, that when these villages are liberated from Boko Haram, they're just smoking ruins and there's no people. We know that there were hundreds of schoolgirls captured some time back, and that became a national embarrassment to the Goodluck Jonathan government. And his own wife apparently tried to suggest that somehow this was all the work of the opposition. And
indeed.
You know, as though this was all an attempt to discredit Nigeria's good name rather than deal with a hideous reality. But the town of Demasak, apparently Boko Haram militants kidnapped more than 400 women and children from this indeed. Northern Nigerian town just a few days ago. 506 young women and children were taken. So what's going on there? I mean, in other words, they're not finding any people or any, they're not freeing any victims of kidnapping, are they? In fact, they seem to be adding to the numbers.
Well, this massive kidnapping that took place at Damascus seems to me to have taken place as Boko Haram was withdrawing in the face of Chadian activity. But you're absolutely right. Here and there, occasionally, you will find a report of very small numbers of the now hundreds upon hundreds of people who've been kidnapped being released. But to go back to the Chibok girls, for example, the group that got the greatest publicity in this country, they seem to have absolutely disappeared. In other words, the Nigerians are reoccupying areas that Boko Haram took, but they're not finding any of these kidnapped women and children. What's happened to them? Where are they? I suspect that they're deep in the countryside, that what Boko Haram is doing is, as it is dislodged from towns, it's returning to the countryside and probably also to slums in Maiduguri, from which it is continuing to carry on operations, particularly against soft targets.
So are these young women either dead or are they jihadi brides? What do you think their fate is?
Yeah, good question. I would suspect, based entirely on the rhetoric of Abubakar Shekau, the face of one part of Boko Haram, I expect a certain number of them have indeed been made jihadi brides. There was also a very chilling report of a day or two ago that when Boko Haram withdrew from a particular town, it proceeded to murder the jihadi brides so they wouldn't fall into the hands of anybody else.
So the obvious, I mean, at least to my mind, one of the more likely explanations for this sudden military reversal where the Nigerians are making strides against Boko Haram, who've basically been occupying huge chunks of territory for the longest time, may well have to do with these South African mercenaries. And I imagine that's the last thing that the Goodluck Jonathan government wants to admit, that it has to have its irons taken out of the fire by South African mercenaries.
And the Jonathan government doesn't even acknowledge that they're mercenaries. He calls them technical advisors.
I see.
And the Nigerian government is remarkably silent about the activity of the Chadians and the Nigerians. It doesn't deny it, but the most you can get are statements to the effect that what the Chadians and the Nigerians are doing is being coordinated by the Nigerians, though there's precious little evidence of that.
But you were saying earlier, Ambassador Campbell, that when the mercenaries and the Chadians and the Nigerians liberate the territory from the Boko Haram, that the Nigerian military is slow to reoccupy, if
at
all.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So they haven't improved at all, by the sound of it. And I think when we last spoke, we're talking about soldiers who are only given a few bullets. And I've seen BBC reports of soldiers complaining, saying we could fight these guys, but we're not getting the equipment.
That's right.
So that's a strange thing, isn't it, for a government to keep its military weak when the country has a history of military governments?
Yes and no. The military has been progressively starved of both human and materiel resources ever since the failure of a military coup in 1990. In other words, a response to the threat of military coups, both by military governments but also by civilian governments, was you weaken the military. And, that's now come home to roost.
So then, just in closing, Ambassador Campbell, what did you make of the recent announcement by Boko Haram that it was joining the so-called Islamic State, or Daesh, as the local people in the Iraqi Syria area prefer to call them?
Essentially, that it was a propaganda move that benefits Boko Haram. It raises Boko Haram's profile. That particular act got it back on the front pages of American newspapers. Boko Haram loves publicity. But it also was a propaganda coup for ISIS. I don't think it is a sign of tactical or strategic coordination between the two organizations, which have a very different focus and are very far apart. The security threat posed by ISIS to the United States and to Western Europe, it seems to me, is particularly ISIS's ability to recruit Europeans and North Americans to go fight for it, learn terrorist tactics, become thoroughly radicalized, and then go home where they can make mischief. Boko Haram has never attracted foreign fighters. Nigeria is a very difficult place. It's hard for me to imagine that Boko Haram would have the attractive power to isolated and disillusioned Europeans or Americans that ISIS has. However, this new sort of relationship between Boko Haram and ISIS may encourage jihadi fighters in West Africa, in places like Mali, to go to Boko Haram and join up.
Well, Ambassador John Campbell, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador John Campbell, who is a Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies and a career Foreign Service Officer and former ambassador to Nigeria. He was a political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections, and his book, Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, is now in its second edition. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the real cost of coal. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Stock, who's a professor of economics at Harvard University and a member of the faculty at the Harvard Kennedy School. He previously served as a member of the President's Council on Economic Advisers from 2013 to 2014, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, The Real Cost of Coal. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Stock.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
And it's pretty alarming to think that the taxpayer... 40% of the coal extracted in this country is from public land, so it's our coal, if you will, and the royalty payments are pretty meager, and apparently they're not even often paid. So the taxpayer is getting hosed.
Well, there are a number of issues with the royalty system as it currently exists. It's complex. It's a relatively small amount. And there's a number of technical issues that need to be addressed to make sure that the taxpayer is getting fair consideration. But the real thrust of our op-ed is that in addition to these technical concerns to make sure that the taxpayer gets fair value, we think it makes sense that the cost of coal or the price charged for coal should reflect a cost for the climate damage that it does when it's being burned.
Well, as you know, the leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, he suggests that there's such a thing as a war on coal being prosecuted by the Obama administration. And now he's found a way around the Obama administration and the EPA by going to all the states and trying to enlist them in lawsuits. So is this some ammunition for a countervailing effort here that you're providing?
Well, you know, I don't think it's really fair to say that there's a war on coal. There's significant concern about climate change and about the global warming that's being induced by CO2 emissions. So there should be a war on CO2 emissions, or more precisely, there should be an economically sensible way to approach reducing CO2 emissions. Coal happens to be the fuel that produces the largest amount of CO2 emissions, so it's the one that is the first order of business to deal with reducing the amount of CO2 emissions from coal.
And it's much more identifiable, surely, because these are stationary sources.
Sure, most of that's correct. And so the clean power plan that's been proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency is focusing on existing stationary sources that are burning coal for electric utility generation.
And how much has the fracking boom and the fact that the United States has become the largest supplier of natural gas in the world, that surely has affected the power portfolio, hasn't it, for power generators?
Oh, sure, absolutely. There's been a big shift away over the last several years away from burning coal to cheaper natural gas. The price of natural gas has come down tremendously, as I'm sure many of your readers know, and that's made natural gas power production a much more attractive feature. It still is the case, however, that a very large amount of our CO2 emissions come from electric utility generation of electricity by burning coal. And so there are additional steps that need to be taken above and beyond these salutary market forces that are helping natural gas be a transition fuel.
So how much then is Mitch McConnell in saying that the Obama administration is conducting a war on coal? How much of this is in fact is he scapegoating the administration? It's clear the administration wants to tackle global warming. We have a peculiar situation where the head of the Senate committee overseeing science is a global warming denier. So there's an enormous amount of resistance from the Republican Senate to even acknowledge the existence of global warming. But it sounds to me like market forces are really conducting a war on coal more than anybody else.
Well, I'm probably not the best person to comment on the politics. I'm an economist. But it is the case that the market forces are making efforts, or the market forces are making it convenient for utilities to move towards natural gas. But market forces by themselves are not always enough. We know that when there's an externality, that when doing something like emitting CO2 emissions imposes costs on others and on future generations, if those costs aren't reflected in the price of the coal or of the CO2 emissions, then there's going to be too much of those emissions. And so there's steps that need to be taken above and beyond the market forces that are reducing natural gas prices.
Well, you were with the Council on Economic Advisers, James Stock, and apparently, according to your article in the New York Times, the Council on Economic Advisers documented in its report last July the long-lived nature of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and concluded that their costs will continue to rise. I imagine if you deny the existence of global warming, then you're not going to take responsibility for these costs.
Well, I think that the evidence of global warming, or I should say more precisely, climate change as a result of greenhouse gas emissions is overwhelming. It's something that the scientific community has documented. It is happening, and these costs are ones that we're starting to see now, but of course will be much more substantial in the future. The longer the wait, we wait to do something about it meaningful, the more expensive it's going to be when we actually have to get around to doing it, because we'll have more CO2 emissions in the atmosphere, and it'll be more expensive to take sharp reductions later. So it's time to get started now.
And again, I'm speaking with James Stock, who is a professor of political economy at Harvard University and a member of the faculty at Harvard Kennedy School. He previously served as a member of the President's Council on Economic Advisers from 2013 to 2014 and has an op-ed with David Hayes at the New York Times, The Real Cost of Coal. So when you say in your article that in 2013, approximately 40% of all domestic coal came from federal lands, would that include lands where they're conducting mountaintop removal in Appalachia?
By and large, not. Most of the federal coal that's mined, not all of it, but most of the federal coal that's mined is in western states, in Montana and Wyoming. The predominant source of federal coal is surface mining on in the Powder River Basin, although there's a number of other sources of federal coal, but most of it's out west.
And what are the obligations on the part of these mining companies who extract coal from federal lands? Do they restore the lands?
So that the particulars vary from case to case, so I couldn't comment on the general situation, but underground mines are treated differently than surface mines. But the focus here is on the not the local environmental issues, but on the climate change issues associated with the coal burning.
So in terms of Mitch McConnell's strategy to fight the EPA by going to the states and encouraging lawsuits from all the states, how is that proceeding? I mean, is there, I'm just curious to know how, you know, I believe it, is, has it reached the Supreme Court? I think, I mean, a while back, the Supreme Court ruled, did it not, that the EPA can regulate air pollution?
Yeah, so there's been a series of Supreme Court rulings and a Circuit Court of Appeals rulings that the EPA cites to bolster or to make its case that, in fact, it is not just able to, but is required to regulate CO2 emissions under the Clean Air Act. And that's all laid out in online legal documentation provided with the rule. You know, the Clean Air Act requires the federal government to set guidelines, and in this case, guidelines or frameworks that are then going to be implemented or standards that are going to be implemented by the states. It'll have to be played out in court to see what happens if some states do choose not to comply. And although there's discussion of that right now, I mean, we would just have to wait and see how all of that works. I think what I would emphasize on the positive side is that quite a few states are working eagerly to comply because they realize that CO2 emissions are a problem. They realize that the Clean Air Act is there to protect the environment, not just our environment, but the environment of future generations. And they're working to make sure that they can do as efficient a job and as economically sensible a job as possible to comply with these regulations. And that's a very constructive and mature approach that most of the states are taking.
But how then does Mitch McConnell's strategy work out if the Supreme Court, which is the final word in the law of the land, what is he trying to do at the state level that would effectively gut the authority of the EPA?
Well, I mean, ultimately, these things will have to be decided in court. And so we will just, you know, those will just play out. And that'll be ultimately a fairly long saga. The rules are not even final. So there's at the moment no basis. One needs to have final rules before you can actually sue over a final rule. And the rules require states to actually take action. The EPA could, for example, or hypothetically, propose a compliance plan that would be imposed on it if it chooses not to comply. I don't think anybody wants to go there. That's not a desirable outcome. And it doesn't. It's not an outcome that would make sense for any of the states either.
Well, apparently Mitch McConnell has gotten a colleague there at Harvard, a constitutional lawyer, a very famous one, Lawrence Tribe, to work on his behalf and on behalf of Peabody Energy. So there's some legal clout being applied to the idea, I guess, that making it a kind of states' rights issue, whether the EPA can wrest control of the state's energy policy.
You know, I'm not the right person to comment on the legal side, but
sure.
EPA is not trying to set energy policy for the states. It's regulating a pollutant that has been deemed by the courts to be a pollutant that can be regulated under the Clean Air Act, and that's what it's doing.
So it just feels like, though, that, you know, we're fighting on all kinds of fronts here, one with the basic idea that there are a number of people, and particularly in high places, like the chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, that don't believe climate change exists. You got Mitch McConnell, who's the leader of the Republican Senate, fighting this battle. And what I found extraordinary about your article, James Stock, in the New York Times, The Real Cost of Coal, is the extent to which the public sort of owns at least 40% of the coal that's being burned in the first place. And you know, there's no way in the world that we don't have a dog in this fight.
I think that's really an important observation. I mean, that this coal that we're discussing in terms of its CO2 emissions when it's burned, a large chunk of that is coming from public lands, and it's coming in a way that does not have compensation associated with the costs of burning that coal in the future.
Well, you know, here in Los Angeles, for example, most of our energy comes from Four Corners, which is a huge plant up in the Mojave Desert at the Four Corners, where the four states in the Southwest join. And it burns coal, and it's been polluting forever and a day. So, I mean, recently the Department of Water and Power said that they're going to phase it out, but not for a number of years. So it feels like we're sort of lagging somewhat in challenging this, I guess, primary source of pollution. Am I correct in suggesting that CO2 from burning coal is the primary contributor to global warming?
Well, CO2 is the primary contributor to global warming, and CO2 and coal is the most carbon-intensive source. So coal is the first, and it generates a large fraction of our electricity. So CO2 from coal-fired power plant combustion is a big chunk of the CO2 emissions in the U.S. and worldwide. So that's the first order of business. But I guess going back to your other comment, one thing about climate change is that CO2 emissions, this is a long-term problem, and we need to start taking action now, but that action can be phased in sensibly. We want to make sure that current electricity power plants have ongoing reliability, that people can have the electricity at a reasonable price to go about their daily business and to do what industry needs to do. And the question is, how are we going to start making that transition or continue making the transition away from carbon-intensive sources of electricity to lower carbon sources of electricity? And we need to start taking those steps now, and that's what the op-ed is about.
Well, just in closing, though, do you think that at the very least the taxpayer is going to get some value for money here if we're not even getting the full royalties?
Oh, I think that this is an important question. So I think that there's room for a lot of improvement in terms of the royalties that we get, in terms of taxpayer compensation for these resources. Our argument is that that compensation should include compensation for the climate damages as well.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, James Stock.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Stock, who is a professor of political economy at Harvard University and a member of the faculty at the Harvard Kennedy School. He previously served as a member of the President's Council on Economic Advisers from 2013 to 2014, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, co-authored with David Hayes, The Real Cost of Coal. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.